to. We're up to how? On page 47. Let's see. Therefore, we are obligated to. Now let's count. Hodos, the Halal, the Shaber, the Fa'er, the Romain, the Hadir, the Berei, the Alei, the Wakhalais. That's nine. These other ones, I'm thinking of the other one. Yeah, Abbas the Kherus is one, the other symbol is two. Able Yom Tov is 3, Echo Gurgle is 4, Shiva Gurgle is 5. No, I seem to remember there was a numerical thing here, but I don't see it. Okay, now, we said how it was split by the meal, and we said that's because the meal is not really an interruption. The first two paragraphs of Halo refer specifically to leaving Egypt. The rest of Howell refers in very general terms to the fact that God runs the world and does miracles with Jewish people. It's not focused directly on the Exodus from Egypt. The first paragraph of Howell really is a general picture of the purpose of creation. This paragraph, this 113th psalm, expresses, I would say, quite clearly some of the themes that I have been telling you in various guises, in various different contexts. So I want to take you through it so you'll appreciate it and see that these ideas go back pretty clearly, in this case, to King David. Of course, they go back to Moses. This psalm has 9 verses. And they break up into 3 groups of 3, which is very convenient, so to speak. The first 3 are praise your servants of Hashem, praise the name of Hashem. Blessed be the name of Hashem from now and forever. From the rising of the sun to its setting, Hashem's name is praised. That's the first 3, and there you have talking about praising Hashem. Now, second 3. High above all nations is Hashem. Above the heavens is His glory. That's 1. Who is like Hashem our God, who is enthroned on high? That's 2 in terms of verses. And I don't know, the yet isn't really in Hebrew. Now they write deigns to look. Is there a clue what deigns means? No. Yeah, you know. Tell them.
In French, I mean, I know what it means to explain is a whole different question. It's like you're giving me the honor of like talking to me. Like.
That's right. You're a noble person, and you are doing the other person a favor by reaching way below yourself and interacting with him. Now, the literal Hebrew is lowers himself. Hashpil means to lower. So, your translator takes it as social and psychological. Okay? But, in literal terms, it means that he is in and of himself so high that it is a lowering for him to look at even the heavens. If you have this picture that God lives in heaven, you know, cosign that to 6-year-olds and the people who study Norse mythology, which they shouldn't do, but it had nothing to do with us. The heavens are another created thing. It's like the earth is a created thing. God doesn't live in the heavens. God transcends the heavens, so he lowers himself to look into the heavens. That's the end of the middle 3. And then you have the last 3. He raises the destitute from the dust. From the trash heaps, he lifts the needy. To seat them with Now, the literal Hebrew is philanthropist. You know what that is? People who give money. Nadiv. Nadiv is a person who is generous of heart and gives. With the philanthropist of his people, he transforms the barren wife into a glad mother of children. That's the last three. Now, there's a lot in this song. I just want to focus on one main point. The first three talk about praising God's name. The second three talk about God's transcendence, that he's above the world, that he's above the heavens, that he's beyond all the nations. And the last three describe what he does. So, saying that God is beyond, above, transcendent, is an introduction to describing what he does. You are describing where he does it from, so to speak. God relates to us in a variety of ways, from a variety of positions, and when you know that an action is coming from a particular position, you can understand the meaning of that action. To say that God is taking a position of utter transcendence, above everything, and doing this, what it means is that this action represents the purpose of the whole creation. If you pictured it coming from a lower level, then maybe it's a local concern, maybe it's a means to a local end. When you picture it coming from high above, it means, high above means the perspective of the whole, it means it's a position from before the creation, it's the vision of the whole purpose of creation. So when in the last three verses it describes what God is doing, those three verses become extremely important because they are a vision of the purpose of the whole creation. So let's look at them again and see what they say. He raises the destitute from the dust, from the trash heap, he lifts up the needy. He's caring for the poor. Wow. Would you have thought caring for the poor is the purpose of creation, or maybe one of the chief purposes of creation? You know, my thought would have been, if it happened to be poor people, God, in his mercy, cares for them. Then he places them with philanthropists. Is philanthropy the opposite of poverty? When you lift a person up from poverty, I would have thought you make them rich or comfortable. That's the opposite of poverty. Why do you go from poverty to philanthropy? And then how does the barren wife get in there? Now, there are lots of people in trouble, lots of people who are needy, sick people, injured people, blind people, people with emotional disturbances. Why would, together with poverty, the other example of help that God gives be for infertility? Now, the key to understanding this passage is a statement in Chazal, in the Talmud. Chazal says there are four categories of people who are, now, the literal statement is, who are nechshav kemeis. They're thought of or evaluated as dead. Now, those who've been around me for a while, you know already that Chazal will make what in words is a general absolute statement and mean by it only one tiny narrow application. That's the way in which Chazal wrote. And the first thing when you hear a general statement is to ask, where does it apply? When does it apply? To what circumstances does it apply? If you don't say that, you don't get that straight, you will blow the point that Chazal is making way out of proportion to the reality. So what Chazal mean here is that these four categories of people don't have all the normal expected resources for living. It's not that they're regarded as dead, that they don't have to do mitzvos, or that the mitzvos don't count, or that people should stay away from them, or the Kohanim can't come to their presence because they become tamei. I mean, that's not what it means. What it means is, if you understand what the purpose of life is, and you look at their circumstances, they don't have the full range of normal opportunities for life. What are the four categories? The poor, the blind, the Metzora, the which is mistranslated as leprosy, mistranslated as tzaraas, and the barren. These four categories of people, say Chazal, don't have the full range of opportunities for life.
Okay.
What does that mean? In what way are they crippled in terms of their ability to live, so to speak? And the answer is that all four lack the normal range of opportunities to do chesed, to perform loving kindness. And they subdivide into two subcategories. Two out of the four lack the full range of opportunities because they don't have the normal resources to do chesed. And two out of the four lack the normal range of opportunities because they don't have the normal connection with recipients for doing the chesed. So here's how it goes. The poor don't have the monetary resources to be able to help other people in the way that normal people do. Of course, they can do other types of chesed. They can do chesed with their person. They can visit people in the hospital. They can give advice. They can help people clean up disasters. But other people can do all of those things and can also support people with their money. And these people can't. So they lack the normal range of opportunities to help others. Blind people can do wonderful chesed, all sorts of chesed, but a blind person will never give you a ride to the supermarket. Cannot help you choose a decorating scheme for your living room, you know, at least not by perception, that's the way you would need it. A blind person is dependent upon other people's help, and there's a range of help that a blind person cannot give you. You sent a note in Chinese, and he said, "So here, tell me what this means." The person's blind, he can't do that for you. Give no Chinese back with the forth, but he can't see the note, nothing he can do for you. So the poor and the blind are restricted in their opportunities to do chesed because they lack the normal range of means to do chesed. Person with tzaraas is excluded from the community. He has to dwell outside the city, and even outside the city he has to be in isolation. If somebody comes near, he has to call out, "Tomei, Tomei, I'm defiled, don't come close." He's put into total isolation. He can't even get you a cup of coffee. You know, he can't even pass the salt. He's cut off entirely from his ability, or almost entirely, his ability to do chesed for other people. And the same is true with infertility. You haven't experienced this yet, I'll warrant, but Yes Hashem, someday you will. You have children who need you. There are young children who have inexplicable pains. Colic is one thing. A child can cry for 20 hours a day for 3 weeks. That's really nerve-wracking, for you anyway. Right? He barely sleeps, he manages to hold it off while he eats, and he's crying 20 hours a day. And you pace up and down with the child, you put him in warm blankets, and you put on music, and you sing him lullabies, you pat his back and everything else. He's crying 20 hours a day. Now, when you're holding the child and pacing up and down with the child, you don't get tired, you don't get frustrated, you don't get irritated. It's your child, and he's in pain. And you're doing whatever you can to relieve his pain. Having children calls forth a response of chesed in people that they themselves weren't aware they possessed. You wouldn't have known that you possessed the capacity for so much chesed. So, the Metzora, who's excluded from human company, and the barren person, lack the normal connection with recipients that gives you the range of opportunities to do chesed. Now, since doing chesed is the purpose of life, therefore these people aren't fully alive. That's what the Gemara is saying. Doing chesed is the purpose of life, and therefore these people who lack the normal range of opportunities to do chesed aren't fully alive. Okay, now let's see if you can put two together, and not get three or five, but get four. What then is King David telling us here? What is God doing? Before you ask your question, let's get the answer to this. What is God doing here?
Well, I mean, it starts out that it says that he raises the He raises the destitute from the dust and all this stuff, and we're supposed to be like God. And since he did chesed for us, our mission life is to become like God and do chesed. And since these people can't do chesed, they are not fully alive.
So what is God doing? You said, but you know, I want you to put it in the terms that will answer my question directly. What is God doing? God is
giving us life by life.
Right.
By making us like him, that's the only way to live.
He's giving us life by giving us the ability to give. That's the one sentence answer. He's giving us life by giving us the ability to give. Now, notice that King David chose one candidate of each of the two subcategories. He chose the poor for the subcategory of those who lack the means, the resources, and he chose the barren woman from the subcategory of those who lack the natural connection with the recipient. Why did he choose those two? I don't know, but you could guess that they're the more common. Poverty is more common than blindness, and infertility is more common than tzaraas. But what you understand is that King David was making reference to both categories. And what it says is he's giving them the ability to give, because in that way he gives them total life, full life, complete life. That being the purpose of the whole creation. This psalm is packed full with deep implications. I don't mean to contrast it with other psalms. I'm sure the other psalms are packed full as well. I just don't know how, you know, I can't explain this. So, yeah.
Why is it only limited to those four categories? I mean, surely a handicap for someone in a wheelchair also lacks the necessary resources.
I agree with you, and I have wondered about this. And my inclination is to say that these are just four examples, and it should apply more broadly. I'm just disturbed by the fact that it says four. Arba, Meshavim Kameis. If it really is strictly four, and it's not supposed to be generalized further, then I don't have an answer to the question. I think it's a good question. It's the right question to ask. I don't have a good answer to it. Yeah.
So why do we put them with the Nidivim and not give them money?
Good. So now, what is the spiritual curse in poverty?
She has to take and not give.
You have to take. There are poor people who live poor. They don't take. But you can't give. Spiritually, the opposite of poverty is philanthropy. Because when you look at poverty, the mere fact that a person doesn't have money doesn't mean anything. You know, Reverend Zisha was extremely poor. He had really had nothing. And the Maggid sent two of his talmidim to him to ask him, how does he make the blessing, trustfully called Tzarki, God has provided for all my needs. Anybody had nothing. So they went and asked. And the Zisha said, for me, poverty is a need. I need poverty. And he provided me with all my needs. He's given me poverty that I need. Right? That's fine as long as you're talking about your needs. On the other hand, if you're talking about what you can do for other people, so then poverty is poverty is a spiritual debility because makes you incapable of giving to others. So in spiritual terms, the opposite of poverty is the lesson.
So he's pretty much putting the poor people as to be in the...
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah, I was just going to say, it sort of connects to his last statement. The same way Hashem sort of lowers himself for us to be able to connect. He lowers himself like the same way like the philanthropist by giving to the poor, sort of, it's like a humbling sort of process. For, you know, for them to, you know,
I think that's
hard
a very,
way.
I think that's a very good comment, a very sharp comment. There's a statement in Chazal that God is humble. And you find examples of his humility in the Torah and in the prophets and in the writings. And it quotes verses from each one. You know what? Give me a sitter, please. It's at the very end of Yitn Lecha, which you say on Saturday night. Thanks. Now, you know, there's got to be something that has to be analyzed. What would it mean to say that God is humble? God is humble. Goodness gracious. You know, what meaning does that have? We talked about humility, we talked about what Ramchal says about humility, but you know, it doesn't easily and naturally fit God. Now, however, we have the statement of Chazal. Amar Rabbi Yochanan. Rabbi Yochanan said, every place you find God's greatness, there you find his humility. It's written in the Torah, in the prophets, and the writings. It says in the Torah, for Hashem, your God, who he is the God of gods, the master of masters, the God who is great, mighty, awesome, who will not show favoritism, not take a bribe, and written right after it, he does the judgment of the orphan and the widow, he loves the convert, give him food and clothing. Means he's caring for the unfortunate. It says in the prophets, thus says the one who is high, two words for high, Shochinad, dwells forever, and his name is holy, high and holy I will dwell, and to be together with the contrite and low of spirit, to give life to the weak and the contrite, people who are small. And it's said a third time in the writings, say praise to God, sing his name, praise the one who rides in the heavens with his name, exalt before him, and says right after it, the father of orphans, the judge of widows, Hashem is in the place of his holiness. So in all three cases, what does it mean that God is humble? I understand. I'm reading, and you're thinking, okay, in 3 minutes we'll get to the answer, so take a mental rest. In all three cases, God's humility is that he cares for the low, the poor, the unfortunate, the sick, the disaster, disadvantaged. This is an interesting aspect of humility. In other words, humility is the antidote here to the feeling, I'm too great to bother myself with that. Let's see. Who does that remind you of? I'm too great to bother myself with that. You don't know, see? I mean, for the calf. I don't think it. No, I'm sorry, I'm misreading it over there. He doesn't say, I'm too great to bother myself with that. He says, that's what you were created for. Why are you protesting? That's your position. No. I have to think back too far ago. How about Haman?
Maybe one of her mortals.
Yeah, it was to him contemptible that he should strike Mordechai alone. I'm the prime minister. I'm going to show that I'm so upset by this one Jew. I can't do that. Go after the whole people. That's a thing that a prime minister could do. He could administer the kingdom and go after the wiping out of the whole people. But to go after Mordechai himself, I'm too big for that. That's not something that I could, you know, justify being concerned about. Here, the creator of the universe is concerned about everyone, including those who are the smallest, those who are the least significant, those who are the downtrodden. That's a symbol of, that's an aspect of humility. Okay, so that's what I'm saying. I'm agreeing with what you said. The idea of lowering himself, like the philanthropist will lower himself to be concerned with such a person. That's imitating God's humility in this sense of humility. That is a very good observation.
Where is that whole bit that you read?
It's the Yitzhakha at Saturday night at Maariv. You do Mizrashkanas in Maariv. It's a long passage.
At the end of Maariv.
Yeah. But at Maariv Saturday night. And yeah. It's a special place in the city. Okay. I'll just tell you one thing in this blessing that we make at the end here. It says on page 49, we ask God to restore the temple, and we say that when it's restored, we'll come to bring our sacrifices there. And 6 lines down in the English, we'll then sing a new song of praise to you for our redemption, etc. Now, in Hebrew, it says, doesn't really say exactly what it says, but 5 lines down, little line, the middle of the call, Shir Hadash. New song. Okay, Shir means poetry, but not I've written right now. Now, in Hebrew, in the Tanakh, there are 2 words used for this kind of ecstatic poetry. One is Shir, and the other is Shiro. On the surface, they're used more or less interchangeably. But of course, we know it's a different word. It can't be interchangeable. Indeed, let's see, where is that? Let me have one of the blue books, please. I'll show you something fascinating. Was pointed out to me by Mechavusa just recently. I missed it. But he is, among other things, Balkuri. So, you know, the exact formulation is something that he pays very careful attention to, and therefore he picks up things that other people often don't pick up. When Miriam and Aaron speak against Moses, complaining about the fact that he separated from his wife, and God says to them, "How dare you speak against Moses? Don't you know that I interact with him in a plane that no one else equals?" So, in the English, words like this. Hear now my words. If there shall be prophets among you, in a vision shall I, Hashem, make myself known to him. In a dream I shall speak to him. Not so as my servant Moses. In my entire house he's the trusted one. Mouth to mouth do I speak to him. In a clear vision and not in riddles. Okay, so now I have vision twice. So your English translator, helpfully, points out that when God is speaking about the lower prophets, it says vision. And when he speaks about Moses, because there's a clear vision. So, okay, that would express the superiority. But actually, in Hebrew, there's no word clear. So in the Hebrew, it sounds like, you know, Moses is superior to everybody else, but I communicate with the others in a vision, I communicate with Moses in a vision. That doesn't express a superiority. But there's a difference in the word. That in expressing it with respect to the other prophets, it's mar'ah. And expressing it with respect to Moses, it's mar'eh. The same letters in Hebrew, mem, resh, aleph, hey, But Mar-O is the feminine. And Mar-E is the masculine. And there's a difference in the meaning of the word if it's feminine or it's masculine. It's not the same word. And Mar-O, the feminine use of the word, is what's used to refer to what all the other prophets get. And Mar-E, the masculine word, is what's used to describe what Moses gets. And they're not the same. So here I'm pointing out, as the commentators point out, when you talk about this ecstatic, poetic praise of God, sometimes called shiro and sometimes called shir, there's a difference. It's not just, you know, a trivial variation. One of the commentators makes a simple surface point here, which is, if you didn't hear it, you'd never think of it. Women normally go through salvations numerous times in their lives. Giving birth is a life-threatening procedure. Don't make a mistake. True, in our times, very few women die in childbirth. That's not because childbirth isn't dangerous. It's because we know how to protect them against the danger. This is actually a point that's made by the Moshe Feinstein, that I was also in the Chuvah of his. I'm going to read the other things. So they experience repeated salvations. But because of the very fact that it's repeated, it means the salvations are not complete. A woman has a child. She knows that in the natural course of things, she's going to have another child. So she's going to be reinserted into that kind of danger and have to be saved again. So shiro, the feminine form, means a temporary salvation. Shir, the masculine form, means a permanent salvation. Now in this blessing, you're talking about the temple being restored, the Mashiach coming, and the ultimate redemption taking place. And that's why it says shir, it doesn't say shiro. And that's why at the Red Sea, when they crossed it, there was a shiro. Yes, they were saved from the Egyptians, but plenty of times in later history we were attacked and subject to the pressure of other peoples, and we have to be saved again and again. So that was a temporary salvation. That's why it was shiro. Okay? It's nice when things work out. Okay, then you wash and make up ramotzi, make a blessing out of matzah, and you eat the matzah, then you blessing on the morer, and you eat the morer, and then you have what is colloquially called the Hillel sandwich. Right, take two pieces of matzah, you put the morer in between, and you say, remembrance of the temple, the Jewish Hillel did in temple times, he would combine paschal sacrifice, matzah and morer. Some people don't say the word paschal sacrifice, okay? In a sandwich, eat them together. To fulfill what's written in the Torah. Now, in the Torah it says, al, matos, umor yachlu. Al sometimes means on. Doesn't mean on here, so it could mean in addition to, or it could mean together with, or it could be such in a few ways. The paschal sacrifice we've eaten al matzah and my Rebbe made a very, very important and acute observation here. Zechel Mikdash, memory of the temple. There's a lot of things we do in memory of the temple. When you get married, chances are, not everybody does this, but chances are, they will burn up some paper and take the ashes and put them on your forehead to remember the destruction of the temple of Jerusalem. And you will step on the glass. I hope that they will get you a nice fragile glass so that you don't have to embarrass yourself by stamping down it 7 times till it breaks. Remind the people in charge to get a fragile glass. I've seen it, but it took a sturdy glass and it was very embarrassing. Got pounding away and it's not breaking. That day, Chol HaMikdash, and many people have the custom of leaving a portion of the wall painted in the house, Zechel Mikdash, and there are many who have a halakhic dispute about listening to music, what kind of music, at what times, Zechel Mikdash, and we have fasts during the year that are Zechel Mikdash. The theme is the temple is destroyed and we are like orphans, that we don't have the temple, and we therefore mourn the loss of the temple. What's going on here in our village? Is this a note of sadness injected into the Haggadah? Zechel HaMikdash. Gosh, we don't have the Mikdash. Sounds a bit out of place, number one. And number two, why would you make your Zechel for the Mikdash to do what they did in the Mikdash? Is that how you commemorate the loss of the Mikdash, by doing what they did? So Rebbe said there are two different ways commemorate the Mikdash. One is to mourn over its loss, and the other is to realize those aspects of Mikdash that are still available today and rejoice in them. And when Chazal said, do X Zechel Mikdash, when the X is something which was done in the times of the Mikdash, then it's the positive side of Zechel Mikdash, not the negative side of Zechel Mikdash. Anybody know another example? No, that was always done everywhere. That was always done everywhere. Taking a lulav 7 days. Where did the idea of taking a lulav 7 days come from? Because the Torah says that that's what was done in the Mikdash. When the temple was standing, everywhere outside the temple, the lulav was taken 1 day. And that's it. 1 day. It's over. Well, okay, we imitated there, maybe that's a good candidate. And so what the Rav Mizrachi said, I'm going to make a Darabon, that you should take the lulav 7 days, because that's the way it was done in the Mikdash. That is not injecting a note of sadness into Sukkot. Zechel Mikdash, oh my gosh, the temple's destroyed. On the contrary, it's rejoicing in what aspect of Mikdash we still have available to us. Similarly, if he says that we make, of course not the real temple, but that was made in the courtyard of the temple, but we make an imitation, says Zechel. So it's also the same thing. So there are two aspects, and the Rebbe tied this to a general observation that the Torah limits mourning. Does not allow a person to get carried away with mourning, to lose his balance, to lose his focus. Yes, being sad is appropriate, and registering the sadness is appropriate, but not to overwhelm the person with sadness.
But we don't have a Korah Pesach, so we really can't do the correct Korah.
Okay, so we do an imitation Korah. Right? I mean, that's what we're talking about. We're talking now. Otherwise, it wouldn't be Zechel and Mikdash Kehela.
But it's like an imitation, it's not.
Okay, it's an imitation. It's what we have left. Okay, I'm just pointing out that the phrase Zechel and Mikdash has two very different applications. This is what the Rebbe pointed out. And they force you to realize that you have, there's a limitation on how much you should emphasize the misery of losing something. Yes?
Certainly, the question you asked about why there's no negative attitude for being placed in Egypt in the first place.
Oh, yes. We didn't talk about that. Yes, I asked that and I didn't answer it. I asked, if we are celebrating, expressing our gratitude to God for taking us out of the slavery of Egypt, isn't it He who put us there in the first place? Yes, it is. So then, it's a little funny, you know, if somebody put you into a terrible situation and then took you out, to thank Him for taking you out, seeing that He put you there in the first place. So what must you say? You must say that having been in that terrible situation had a function. It had a function. It's something that had to be done for some reason or other, which all the Svarim talk about. Definitely had a function. Now, if it had a function that had to be done, then why are you thanking Him for taking you out? So, especially if you're not thanking Him for putting you in. So I think the idea here is this. Now, this is tied up in a few Gemaras, and some of my friends don't see it exactly the way I see it. I've not yet been convinced that I'm wrong. So I'm saying this because I respect my friends, and they see it differently. So then, there's a difference between acknowledging that something good has happened, which is one level, expressing gratitude, which is another level, and singing praises, which is another level. There are various levels. And if someone benefits you by causing you pain, so it's appropriate to acknowledge that something good has happened, and it's appropriate to be grateful, but to enthusiastically and excitedly sing his praises is not appropriate, because it happened through pain. And since it happened through pain, it was partial. It was not a total it was not a total benefit. It was a benefit that came through a loss. Okay, maybe I was in a position where the only way I could get the benefit is through the loss. You know, the example that I used in this connection was, imagine a person who, God forbid, has gangrene in his foot. And the doctor therefore amputates his foot to save his life. Will he celebrate? I don't think so. He's grateful, and he'll express his gratitude. He's not going to celebrate the fact that he saved his life by losing his foot. Mashiach came as an opposing case, someone who, let's say, had a temporary paralysis, and the neurosurgeon relieved the pressure on the nerve, and then he gets back full function again. That he could celebrate. So we're talking here about celebrating. Talking about celebrating our freedom. Yes, we can celebrate our freedom. Can we celebrate the slavery? No. We can acknowledge it, and we can express gratitude, but we can't celebrate. I think that's the key difference.
But we sing praises for him taking us out, but that came about through pain. So why should we sing praise?
Well, we're singing praises for the relieving of the pain. But that particular aspect.
You can do that aspect.
And the other aspect we have to express. The original class we started with was, if you're expressing gratitude about going out, so then why don't you have a corresponding negative judgment about having been put there in the first place? The answer is, I know that serves a purpose, but I can't celebrate the being put there because it was done through pain.
I mean, isn't that more a reflection of like, we're like the Midrash we're on, that we're not on a high enough level to like be able to really celebrate? Because I mean, if ultimately, you know, like everything, like what I was saying today, like when we say it's sort of repetitive, like, cause like the chesed is good, but like tovim is like to add the aspect that we can see that it's good,
right?
But like, and then so I always let them, the slavery wasn't like if I said like a chesed tov, but something that we couldn't see, was it? So isn't that just more, if we were on the level to see that it was tov, then we would be able to like sing and to,
I think you're 100% right. 100% right. I was just a comment and then a confirmation. You say if we were, I just recognize that if we were is really impossible. It's really impossible. The deeper point, which you're expressing well, the deeper point here is this. The Ramchal in the Derech Hashem, in the chapter on the Shema, says that if God punishes the wicked with an open miracle, he's hiding. If God punishes the wicked with an open miracle, he's hiding. Now you say, wait a minute, well, let's get this straight. We're an open miracle, right? If it's an open miracle, how can God be hiding? Now here's the answer. Of course, this is built on a whole philosophy, but here's the answer. When we talk about God, we're talking about his will. Nothing beyond his will is something we can understand or talk about at all. Now, what would it mean for a will to be manifest, open, visible? Well, you have to see the event as coming from a certain source. But now, will, the essential element in a will is the purpose. Suppose the will came labeled, this is coming from God. But in the will, in the action, you can't see the purpose. Well, if you can't see the purpose, then the key element is being hidden. Now, the purpose of everything is chesed. The purpose of everything is loving kindness. Says Ramchal, if the wicked are punished through an open miracle, you don't see God's loving kindness to them. What you see them is getting hurt, getting destroyed. So you don't see the loving kindness to them. So the key element in the will, which is the purpose, is hidden. You may know it, but you don't see it. It's not visible. So when God does good, just as he said, when God does good, and the good comes through pain, the key element in the will behind the good is missing. So it's missing. It's not visible to us. Were we able to see that element, experience that element, then we would have been able to say, to sing God's praises on that as well. We're not able to. And here, we're really not able to. We're in a position where we can't do it. But this verse says, Nochum Ishkamzu. Nochum was a person who committed a crime. And he was so devastated, personally, by the crime that he committed, that he called down upon himself a whole bunch of terrible curses. And they all came true. And as each one came true, he said the famous words, Gamzu L'Tova. This too is for him. He's the one who invented those words. And people accepting God's will, even when it hurts, it all comes from him. Now, Esther asked, what blessing do you think he made when each of those terrible things happened? He's the one who says, Gamzu L'Tova. Does he make the blessing, Dayana Emes, on bad things, true judge? I'm judging truth. Or does he make the blessing, Atova Meitiv, on good things? Which blessing did he make, he who said, Gamzu L'Tova? The Esther says he definitely made the blessing, Dayana Emes. Because he too experienced it as a hiddenness and therefore couldn't make a total make. So in our condition, in our world, it's impossible to escape that. But the cause of it is exactly what you say, because we can't see it, we can't experience it that way. Now, as I'll say, that Rossi Lovell, in the future, the only blessing that will be made is a total make. So one way to take it is that in that future time, when we go think what happened. But I also want to say that even on the past things, because what would he then? We'll make it. This goes back to a famous incident in the life of Rabbi Yisrael ben Tishah, and we just thank you quickly that we'll teach. Rabbi Yisrael once said to his chassidim, if I were God, do you know what I would do? So they all pricked up their ears. Wow, if he were God, look at him. What would he do if he ran the world? You know? And he said, if I were God, I would do exactly as he's doing. Why? Because if I were God, I would know what it was all for. I would see how it all connects up. I would see how it's the best of all strategies. The reason I don't feel that way now is because I don't see. But where did I see? I'd be doing exactly as you said. So the point's right on the target.